Welcome to Go Deeper, Wyndham Art Gallery's podcast channel, part of our Go Deeper program that provides an in-depth look at each of our exhibitions. Today you are listening to an abridged recording of the Drowning Not Waving exhibition, featuring curator Pauline Fortuna and artist Jill Orr, Yazabel Kukau, Penelope Davis, and Florence Topola.
Welcome everyone. I want to start by acknowledging the land that we are on and the traditional owners of the land we're on. So Wyndham sits upon the unceded lands of the Wathaurong, Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation. And I want to pay my deep respects tonight to their elders past, present and emerging. My name is Pauline Fortuna and I'm going to be facilitating the conversation tonight. It's very casual. It's very casual tonight. It's an intimate crowd tonight. So I think we're going to have a really friendly, casual discussion about the artworks that these incredible artists have contributed to this exhibition, Not Waving Drowning. I also want to take a moment to acknowledge that today Vic Rhodes and MRPV, flanked by the Victorian Police, have begun the removal of trees on Jabiran Country, which is occurring one day after a rally outside Victorian Parliament to protest this cultural vandalism being carried out to build a stretch of highway for which many have argued there are actually viable alternatives. The catalogue for Drowning Not Waving states that the exhibition asks, what were we thinking when we kept plundering the earth with little thought for the future, and how did we not react to the warning sooner? But I want us to think about that statement, and I think it's important from the outside of this conversation to and really any conversation on the climate emergency, to interrogate who the we is in this statement, who the plunderers are. So what is happening on Jabiran Country now is actually a continuation of the supposed logic of settlers globally, which has led to the climate catastrophe that Indigenous peoples and poor Black people and poor people of colour in particular are now facing. It is the same logic that is forcefully dispossessing the traditional owners of the land in Queensland's Galilee Basin that corporate conglomerate Adani wants to destroy for their Carmichael coal mine. And I would urge everyone to actually look up what is happening in Jabiran at the moment and the work of the Jabiran Heritage Protection Embassy. For those who haven't acquired a copy, and I don't have one on me yet, the catalogue for this exhibition is fantastic, and I would urge everyone to look at the essay that Leuli in particular has contributed, in which they state, the great ocean and all its shores have always been a highway of peoples, birds, mammals, ideas, ceremonies, but now we are faced with the greatest existential threat of climate apocalypse. This disproportionately impacts Indigenous peoples whose lifeways have not created the global heating produced by industrialized countries. It does require us to deeply transform our ways of being in the world, from peoples enjoying the glory days of the decadent city to re-become relations sharing this planet together. And on that note, I wanna introduce the artists. So I'm gonna actually allow the artists to introduce themselves because I think they can represent themselves better than I can. And we'll start with Florence.
Thank you, Pauline. My name is Florence Fulola Topola. I'm a Samoan. I am a storyteller through dance, art, and an activist, dancer. I'm also honored to be part of Pacific Island Warriors, as well as a weaver, weaver of stories.
My name's Yazbel Koko, and I am Fijian German heritage from a teeny tiny island called Batiki, which is maybe like a couple hours boat from the mainland. And I'm an artist. I mostly have a weaving practice, and my weaving practice at the moment is mostly concerned with bringing things back from the dead. So I have been spending a lot of time in archives and in museums finding Fijian weaving practices that we don't practice anymore and trying to figure out how to make them again. And my mentor is actually in the audience, Auntie Vicky Kenai, and every time I find a new weave that I want to try and give a go, I always show a photo to Auntie Vicky Kenai, and she draws me little photos and draws me little images of how I should go about it. So I'm also part of the weaving group that Florence is a part of, Mata'ala, and I wouldn't be here unless I had all those amazing women in my life supporting me. So, yeah.
Oh, me. My name is Jill Orr. I'm a performance artist, and I guess I've been concerned with climate and psychosocial environmental issues for a very long time. And my heritage is Scottish, Irish, Aussie, and I've just had these little skin lumps, skin cancer lumps kind of taken off, so clearly I've got the wrong skin for this country, which I think is the irony that I bear.
I'm Penelope Davis, and I've been an artist for nearly 30 years, and I started out with a using photography in my practice predominantly, and it's really been in the last 7 years or so that I've started using sculpture solely, sculptural techniques. And probably at the same time I started making work that addressed issues of climate change and environmental degradation. And my background is definitely one of a settler. I'm thrilled to be in this exhibition.
One of the first things that you see when you enter Wyndham Cultural Centre and the gallery is Florence's work. So I want to start with you. I want to know about the genesis of the work that you created for this exhibition, and yeah, just what inspired you to make this particular work and have this particular work in this particular exhibition.
The piece is, I guess, a dedication and an honour to my grandmother. I was very honoured, and I know Yaz was there with me at the time. Very recent, I was honoured to be in a circle with people from across the Pacific, and also young Pacific Islanders here in Australia, so from Brisbane and Sydney. And we do this ceremony, and it's an altar ceremony where you welcome an elder to the space. It's the first time I shared the story of my grandmother. And so a year ago, I reconnected with my grandmother's belongings. The last time I saw her was on her deathbed, and I was a young teen adult at the time, so reconnecting with her as a full-grown woman and seeing all her full dresses, which you'll see in the artwork, and they were kept hidden in these containers in her garage, and it really saddened me, but also there was this sense of urgency for me to pick up each garment dress that she had. And I tell you, she's got hundreds. Like, what you see behind you, like, that's probably a quarter of what she has. Like, she has a massive collection. So, and that's a beautiful thing, is that I still have this ongoing journey of going back and collecting all of her garments.
That's perfect. Thank you. Florence, you touched on food security, which I know is a big part of the work that you contributed, Yaz, to this exhibition. Could you talk about Cyclone Food Series and how it came about?
Yeah, Cyclone Food Series came about, it's actually the two pieces, they're actually behind Pauline. It's two corned beef cans, Pacific brand corned beef cans, and they've got these little woven string bags woven into them. And it's actually a part of, there's more works in this series, and it's a series of corned beef cans and also FMF breakfast crackers, which a lot of people
I'm trying to think of what they're called. They're just sayo biscuits.
Yeah, like so. Yeah. Which I think a lot of people in the Pacific are very familiar with. I guess they came about because I was spending time with my auntie in Fiji, and it was actually just after Cyclone Winston had happened. And I normally send back some money to my auntie in Fiji, and I was actually really shocked because of how expensive the food was in Fiji at the time. And it wasn't, and of course I was very naive, and then I realized it was because of the crop destruction, because of Cyclone Winston had increased the food prices. So a lot of people during cyclones, they actually prepare for cyclones by buying lots of non-perishable food, so cans, FMF breakfast crackers, and they're very, very routinely household seen across in Fiji, and then as I discovered also in Tonga. So I can't confirm other islands apart from that. Canned food in Fiji is very colloquially called cyclone food. So that's kind of where the concept came from, was sort of thinking about these foods that we eat because of instances of extreme weather occurrences and the more frequency of them, and how also these foods are they're not actually that great for us. They're not actually what we typically eat in a Fijian diet. And I guess another issue that's happening in the Pacific is, especially in Fiji, there's a huge epidemic of diabetes. A person gets a limb amputated every 12 hours in Fiji. So, I mean, for me, like when I think about all these things, like on a macro level, like I can totally see a direct correlation between extreme weather occurrences, increase in food prices, people eating cheap alternative foods and thus having poorer health outcomes and people getting chronic illnesses like diabetes. I hope that's not such a tenuous link. If people are, yeah, okay, people following. So, yeah, and I think also just like a part of the colonial project is just completely dispersing indigenous farming technologies and techniques and making it impossible for Fijian people to be able to live subsistence lifestyles. I think in capitalist frameworks, we think of subsistence living as really, I don't know what the word is, like it's not, it's very low and middle. I don't know. It's not like sustainable, like subsistence farming. But I think actually more support needs to happen for people to, for indigenous farming techniques and for subsistence farming techniques and all that kind of stuff. Which is also a very easy thing for me to say because I live in Melbourne. I think that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Jill, I wanted to ask you about your work at Detritus Springs. It's really halting. It's really halting work. Like for me, standing in front of it, it is extremely halting. Could you talk about the process of making that work and why you contributed it to this exhibition?
Sure. Performance that's photographed up there was set in this crazy old building full of shit, basically. It was just junk thrown everywhere. There was just some stuff thrown at it, and you know, it was just this mess. And they were in the middle of transforming this building to become kind of apartments. But Julie Collins, who was the curator of the Australian Biennale in Ballarat last year, said, could we put artworks there? And that the building itself was kind of they call it a pork processing place, which really means it was an abattoir slaughtering pig. So the vibe of the place was pretty intense. I chose to be out in this area so you could see this sort of like from the first story, they had a clear glass wall and you could look down at this crazy mess. There's part of me that quite likes the image of apocalypse. I don't know, there's something spare, there's something kind of so pared back, there's nothing left. But it can, for example, like it's just, there's nowhere else to go other than survive. So how do we survive? So it's pure theatre is what I actually did. So I got all these massive amount of smoke machines and literally I just held that for a hell of a long time. So audience could see that, and I did a separate one just for cameras. And, you know, I was so sick after it. It was like, you know, how do you really pollute yourself? That was like a concentrated, really bad thing to do myself, but actually symbolic. It was contained, but it was symbolic of what's going on for years and years in this mass production for profit. And the only one of the things that I often go back to, which was like in this amazing woman called Rachel Carson. She's an American. She wrote this little skinny book called The Silent Spring. And that book talked about, I read it, well, I must have been in fifth form or something like that. And that book talked about stopping DDT poisoning in America. And it was so powerful. And it was that little brief moment in time that actually they did. It got right up to the top of government and they managed to stop the use of DDT. So I've always had, you know, and the idea of the environment, there wasn't even a word kind of then. So my generation has seen this idea and the word just grow and grow and grow till this massive consciousness. But the fear is there, your fear. It's true, it's the fact. And the urgency absolutely can't go away. We can't let it out of our sight. If we let it out of our sight, it's like dropping the ball. It's like all that major focus, human, non-human, just dissipates. So we just have to keep nurturing those. And I think it's not going to happen in one big thing. I think it is voices of everybody. And I think it's not only artists, it's scientists, it's writers, it's accountants, it's kind of fishermen, it's like everybody. And when eventually that amount of action finally tips the politic to say, well, sorry, it's real, we actually need something done, I think that's the massive swell that we're all building.
Thank you. Penelope, I want to talk to you about your work, Future Archaeologies. Can you tell us about it? It's, I mean, when you look at the work, you immediately get the message. it's pretty clear. But I wanted to know about how you came to be making these particular types of structural works.
So I started making work many years ago, as I said, using photography, but my work has often been process generated, and as the process or the technique and the materials build, it's like my mind is working in concert with my hands or something, and then it all starts to make sense as an idea as well. And that's what happened with this work. So I'd started in photography, and then my photographs, I wasn't using a camera, I was using casting and moulding techniques and making objects and using them to make photographic images. And in the end, I just enjoyed the haptic process of moulding and casting so much that I then forgot about the photographic image, or dispensed with the photographic image, and started making sculptures. And at the same time as that was happening, it was about 10 or 11 years ago, and I had so much of our work comes from a historical, personal historical kind of narrative, I suppose. And I had a young son, he was a toddler, and I spent a couple of years, I live in Bayside, Melbourne, a couple of years spending an awful lot of time walking along the beach. And one particular year, the coast was, or the beach was, the water, the shallow waters were clogged with jellyfish, and no one could go in the water, and yeah, it was like something I hadn't actually seen before. And at the same time as I noticed that, I started reading more. It's like I had a radar. I started reading more about, you know, in the media and on the internet about what was going on with climate change and the environmental degradation, and in particular the degradation of the marine environment. And jellyfish were obviously a sign of that, and I started at the same time incorporating that form into the work that I was fiddling around with in the studio. And so then I started collecting discarded objects from my op shops, my kitchen, from but we used to have really good hard rubbish collections in the city of Port Phillip, where en masse every house would put out all their hard rubbish, and I collected a whole lot of waste material, and nearly all of it was from objects that mass manufactured in industrialized countries, that they're either single, like all these single use plastic objects, or electrical kind of detritus or technological detritus that or objects that have inbuilt short lives, they're only built to last 3 years or something, so that then you go out and buy another one. So it's just all this junk, and I started casting in silicon off the surface of all these various bits and pieces, and all the little, I ended up with all these little silicon pieces, and I sewed them together and started to make these jellyfish forms. And I guess it's become an ongoing project. Global warming and environmental degradation is the biggest issue that's facing us. And I think that art, my art's easy to read, but I also wanted it to be evocative. They're not literally jellyfish, but I wanted to entwine or integrate human complicity with the effect it's having on the natural environment. And jellyfish became a really good metaphor for that, because they are like us. They survive and proliferate at the expense of everything else. They're like these big white monstrous things that come in, colonize, sap up everything, and then create a whole lot of waste that makes it impossible for anyone else to live there. So they became this kind of really good emblem of what's happening. And I think I've just lost my train of thought completely. Maybe I should just stop there. But that's
that was great. This is a general question now to everybody on the panel. So Megan Evans, fabulous curator here at the at the gallery, at Windham Art Gallery. In her curatorial note, she asked, can art make a difference to the plight of the rapidly warming planet? And I know, like, Jill, you've been making art on this topic for a long time. I wanted to know what you've observed over time in terms of artists engaging with this topic and its efficacy in the fight. Like, I personally do believe that art has a major role to play in mobilizing people and inspiring change. But I wanted to hear from you about your observations of.
There's some projects that I guess they call them participatory projects, and you guys have kind of already in a way described some of that, whereby bringing people together to do something towards a common goal that's not like something you're going to spend 20 years doing, but it's a short-term focus. But what happens in that communication with all sorts of others that come is a building of a language, a common language and friendship through people, but at the same time the effects and results of that kind of grow bigger than the people that have been involved. So imagine you've got one person and they bring in 10, then there's at least 11, well, 10 times whatever, I can't do maths, but you get what I mean, it's just pushing out there mathematically. So it's sort of, and then, of course, I reckon the social media is extraordinary, because that potential to galvanise is enormous. And we've seen many, you know, like some of, and I mean, all of those sort of things, they really can shake. They can make, you know, big companies quite nervous and justify it. So, I think we're in exciting times. I don't know that I'm necessarily a kind of artist that's going to necessarily do participatory things. Sometimes I just imagine stuff and I just have to pay homage to what I've received. And sometimes that does involve others. But I think that the generations of folk coming through now, it's just so exciting.
I wanted to ask Yasm, Florence, you're both in Pacific Climate Warriors, which I know at the moment has an art competition running for youth, to try and engage youth to basically engage with the topic through art. So I wanted to hear your perspectives on the role of artists and the role of art in this fight, particularly for us, for global Indigenous peoples.
Well, I think for Indigenous people all around the world, art making is such a way of life. And a lot of Indigenous people, I don't want to speak on behalf of all Indigenous people everywhere, but like I think there would be a consensus that like practicing art for us is like very much embedded in how we live our lives. But I guess in the sort of Western world that we live in, something like that I like about being an artist, and I never went to art school, I actually used to be a social worker. And so I used to work in some very bureaucratic structures and did a lot of paperwork and kind of got tired of it after a bit. And something I love about being an artist and working in art making is that it allows you to imagine the world outside of the structures and systems that we live in. And I actually think weaving is a really important practice, because it's one, it's like embedded in our culture and it has so many benefits outside of just, it's teaching someone a skill that they're going to be able to use for their whole life. It's about teaching young people from Pacific backgrounds about something that's from their cultural heritage. And it's also a really great mental health. It has really meditative properties. So I think arts practices have so much value in making our world a better place, if I don't want to sound too utopian in saying that. But it particularly in terms of like the environmental kind of
crisis that we live in, art making is, it gives us the opportunity to envision a world outside of, it just, it gives you the freedom to think really differently than what you might do if you were working in a lab or if you're doing something else. And yeah, so that's something I really enjoy about it. And I think also, like, in the same way that I think every Indigenous person is an artist, I think every Indigenous person is also a scientist as well. So it gives you the ability to think outside of the box completely, and like, just not even think about there was a box in to begin with. Like, just to like imagine something completely different. Yeah, you know. And
is this a pointless endeavor, you know, using issues or incorporating big issues into artwork? But that with something like this, we've all been hearing about the science, and we all kind of know in an abstract way or a literal way, but both of them, about the facts of what's going on. But it's really hard to connect to that information. In fact, that information is incredibly disempowering, I reckon, in the way that it's presented, because of, you know, it's empirical research. But if it, the power of art is that it harnesses the people's imagination, and maybe viewers and practitioners can enter, they enter a space that gives them a very personal connection to the object or the making, and that personal connection involves imagination and then helps people develop a kind of personal explanation of what's going on. It's like an integration of facts and the person and empathy and imagining someone, you know, how that is for someone else, and all of that's incredibly important for galvanizing action and harnessing a kind of intent to change things. It's not disempowering. It's actually empowering to enter that space.
For me, as a Samoan, and I just see art already in our culture, you know, just like what Yaz mentioned, you know, through weaving, through dance, through chants, chanting, you know, it's art. Like, art is such a powerful force for every individual, and it really allows us to, like, to speak up, like, to really vocalize. And there's, when I say, like, culturally, there's this beautiful sense of, me as a Samoan who was raised here in Australia, like, I grew up in rural New South Wales, and so, you know, decolonizing and like reconnecting with, especially with Siwa Samoa. So Siwa Samoa is Samoan dance, and it saw the real like power that I have of, you know, like addressing or sharing like current issues and doing in a practice that is so culturally embedded in us. So for instance, like there's such a power when you tell your people of what's happening, and you do it through a practice that is already ingrained in them, like for instance through dance.
Yeah.
And it really kind of elevates, especially the young people, because it's just like, to them, like, I mean, you know, growing up in Australia, I've met so many, you know, young people in the Samoan community where I grew up in Griffith, New South Wales, and, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like you ignite a flame that's already within them, and you ignite it through I guess just through truth, and truth that does need to be shared and really exposed and heard from their own people, and to do it through a traditional practice that's been ingrained like from the very like from way back. There is something just like so. It's just meant to be. It's like it's so spiritually and like culturally, like a gift to know that like you already have and it in my case it was something that I really had to search for, and to share it, like to tell the young ones that like that there is like power in grasping your culture. And another thing is language as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing as well. It's really beautiful to see the younger generation find power and reconnect through language, and to so it's really amazing to see these submissions from kids across in Melbourne who are expressing their like their stories or ideas through the native tongue. It's really amazing.
Science, how can I explain it? Science sits way aside from culture and personal history, and art can incorporate science and this is what you two have been talking so eloquently about, bringing culture that's hardwired hardwired culture into it all, and integrating it with the catastrophic facts as we know them. And that's another really important role that art can play. And also, I think art can it also bears witness. So I was thinking about recently we had the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square event, and the image that kept popping up in the media was the tanks and the small lone man with the shopping bags, and that's an image,
yeah.
And that sort of says it all. And I don't know, I'm not a big fan of Picasso, but Picasso's Guernica, that bore witness to the horrible things that happened at that time. And it's like a record. It's like artists are keeping track.
I think we might actually leave it there. Could everyone please give a round of applause to our wonderful panel?